Friends, assalamu alaikum. Like every Wednesday afternoon, this is Caravan, broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal or www.ckut.ca on the internet. Caravan brings to you the latest pertaining to Arabs and Muslims at home and abroad. Caravan today is a two-hour packed with news and comments you wouldn't hear anywhere else on the dial. Caravan discusses issues of interest from politics to religion to culture. Caravan is independent of any religious or political organization. I'm Sama Elibiari. The events of September 11, 2001 were devastating tragedies. We ask Canadians to pray in the memory of all victims. 1 year later, it is time to reflect, analyze, and express our concerns about the issues 9/11 represents, both at home and abroad. Caravan presents today a two-hour special, starting at 1 and going till 3 p.m., inshallah. From Israel, Palestine, 1 year later. Sam Bahour, an American Palestinian, businessman, father of two young daughters, talked to Caravan about terrorism and suicide bombing, the struggle of the Palestinian people, and what North American people should realize. Sam Bahour has been living in El Bira, the West Bank, for the last 7 years. He is the author of Homeland, Stories from Palestine. From the Gulf States, Basil Salouj teaches international studies at the American University of Sharjah, United Arab Emirates. He conveys to Caravan the mood prevailing in the Gulf States and reveals the anxiety and frustration of the Arabs towards American intolerance and avoidance of the core issues in the Middle East. An exclusive interview today on Caravan. The effect of September 11 on the Muslims in the UK. Masood Shajari, chairperson, Islamic Human Rights Commission, speaks to Caravan about the bias in the media and the backlash to the Muslim community in the UK. He also reports on the aspiration of Muslims in the UK for a more secure world and voices their opposition to any intervention against Iraq. Victims of September 11, you seldom hear about. There are victims who were killed for no other reason than wearing a turban or having caught an Arab look. The Campaign for Collateral Compassion is working to move the Red Cross and other major September 11-related charity funds to extend relief to the families of 19 individuals who were murdered in the U.S. in the hate backlash after September 11. Anya Cordell, spokesperson for the Campaign for Collateral Damage, speaks to Caravan from Chicago, where she is based. 1 year after September 11, dispelling the myths about Islam and Muslims with Enver Masood, author of The War on Islam. Mr. Masood maintains the website The Wisdom Found at www.twf.org. An exclusive interview for Caravan, plus commentaries and latest news. Our commentary today is by Maher Ali, as published in Dawn, the Pakistani newspaper, and dated September 6 of this year. September 11 is often cited as the day the outside world decided to pay America a visit. The murderous manner of the intrusion was certainly uncalled for and remains worthy of unequivocal condemnation. But let's not lose sight of the fact that the U.S. has been visiting the world for more than a century, often with deadly, albeit usually less spectacular, results. Shock, horror, fear, mourning, these were perfectly natural responses to the enormity of passenger-laden jets plowing into the most potent symbols of American economic and military power. The frenzied flag-waving that followed was also understandable, but ought not these gut reactions have given way in due course to greater introspection? it is at least conceivable that a better America, less insular, less arrogant, less ignorant, could have arisen from the ashes of the Twin Towers? The answer later on our commentary. Stay tuned. This is Caravan. But first, a prayer for all the victims of September 11.
الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Master of the Day of Judgment. You alone we worship, and you alone we ask for help. Show us the straight path, the path of those whom you have favored, not those who earn your anger, nor those who go astray.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca on the internet. This is our special edition of Caravan starting today at 1 o'clock and going till 3 o'clock, inshallah. Today in a press conference, the Canadian Islamic Congress released the following statement. The events of September 11, 2001 were devastating tragedies. We ask Canadians to pray in the memory of all the victims. One year later, it is time to reflect, analyze, and express our concerns about the issues 9/11 represents, both at home and abroad. We Canadian Muslims are committed to work and to pray for an early end to the evil of terrorism in all shapes and forms, those which are committed by states as well as those committed by individuals and groups. We believe that we must also work and pray to end other forms of terrorism, including political militarism and those forms of terrorism which deny liberty, human dignity, self-identity, self-determination, and statehood to people and nations, as well as those terrorism which deny poor and Aboriginal peoples the world over their basic human rights to education and training, health care, adequate shelter, clean water, and sufficient food, and those forms of terrorism which cause slow death to entire countries and communities through the use of economic sanctions, military siege, political and economic injustice. We Canadian Muslims appeal to educators, law enforcement agencies, and politicians to state publicly that anti-Muslim assaults, harassment, insults, and anti-Islam hate speech or literature will not be tolerated. We believe that the public, private, and independent media, print, broadcast, and electronic, should commit to being part of the solution to anti-Islam in Canada by providing balanced coverage of news and views, and not contributing to any form of negative stereotyping or hate mongering. As a living faith with nearly 1.2 billion global adherents, Islam needs no defense, but our children do. As young and vulnerable human beings, Canadian Muslim children need to be protected against the lifelong social and psychological damage inflicted by hate mongering, negative stereotyping, and smear campaigns against their self-identity, self-esteem, and human dignity. We Canadian Muslims believe that it is racist, unreasonable, and unfair to ask only Muslims to condemn acts of violence, oppression, or criminal behavior committed by any Muslim individual or group in Canada and the world, whether committed explicitly in the name of Islam or not. In our recent history, Canadian Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Buddhists, Sikh, Hindu, Irish, Spanish, Greeks, or any other major religious or ethnic groups have not been urged as entire communities to publicly declare condemnation for offenses such as sexual abuse by priests and other religious persons in positions of trust, the occupation of land, economic exploitation, acts of terror, corporate theft, gassing of subways, vandalism, hate literature, or similar violent and socially destructive acts. Only Canadian Muslims as a whole have been called to condemn such forms of terrorism as if they were collectively responsible for them or guilty by association. We Canadian Muslims are very concerned about the increasing pressure to link patriotism, the idea of being a good citizen, with unqualified support for enormous government increase in military spending, the passing of multiple anti-terrorism laws, and the economic and cultural Americanization of Canada at the expense of all other priorities, particularly those that our country traditionally valued, such as the elimination of homelessness and child poverty. We are increasingly concerned that the present Canadian federal government is dominated by a highly polarized decision-making group supported by media moguls who are striving to suspend public critical appraisal and are quick to brand would-be deserters as unpatriotic. 9 months after Bill C-36 was passed into law, the Canadian Islamic Congress requests that the federal government review the effectiveness of this legislation in enhancing the security of Canadians. The infamous C-36 resembles laws enforced by notorious international dictators and racist regimes, such as apartheid South Africa in the 1960s. Among other dangers, C-36 allows for the arrest of any Canadian without warrant. It permits eavesdropping on Canadians' electronic communication. It allows for curtailing the release of government information to the public. The Canadian Islamic Congress has been told by government officials that the anti-terrorist law has not been used in charging any Canadian since last December, and arrests on the scale seen in the U.S. did not occur in Canada. Meanwhile, our government has not yet addressed the vital need to revert national airport security back to the administration of federal agencies, staffed by workers with appropriate training and adequate salaries. We Canadian Muslims believe that the best guarantee of safety in both Canada and the U.S. is to cooperate in striving to achieve security, peace, liberty, and justice for all. These values and aspirations are fundamental to all peoples, not only the rich and powerful, not only Americans and Canadians, but must also embrace Africans and South Americans, Europeans, Asians, and Aboriginals. Only when we Canadians make no distinction between achieving security at home and achieving peace with justice abroad can we achieve true security. We Canadian Muslims are fully aware that the vast majority of our fellow citizens are fair-minded, kind, understanding people. We appreciate the numerous positive gestures received post 9/11. From friends, colleagues, and neighbors. We are also fully aware, however, of those vocal minorities motivated by intolerant religious and/or political agendas who are leading smear campaigns against Islam. To promote broader understanding and communication throughout the Canadian culture, Mosaic Muslims Coast to Coast have offered to host open houses at our mosques during the months of September and October each year. We welcome you all. You're listening to Caravan, brought to you by CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca. Today we have a very special edition for September 11, dedicated to all the victims. Dispelling the myths about Islam and Muslims with Enver Masood, author of The War on Islam. Mr. Masood maintains the website of the Wisdom Fund. In April 2002, he received a gold award from the South Africa-based Human Rights Foundation for his efforts in dedicating himself to unveiling the truth regarding the onslaught against Islam. His letters and commentary on major events affecting the Muslim world have been published in newspapers and magazines, and on the Wisdom Fund website, which receives visitors from about 90 countries every month. The Truth About Islam, which he authored, has been described as the best short introduction to Islam by its readers. An exclusive interview with Enver Mansoud. Mr. Mansoud, thank you very much for being with us. What are your thoughts on this day, 1 year after the tragic events of September 11?
Well, the first thing I think about is all the poor people that died, both in the towers in New York and in Afghanistan afterwards. You know, the numbers are about 3,000 killed in the World Trade Center, of which estimates are 400 or 500 were Muslim, which is not often mentioned in the press. And since then, the U.S. attack on Afghanistan is supposed to have killed about 3,000 or 4,000 civilians there. So my thoughts are with all of those poor people that suffered.
After the events of September 11, Muslim leaders in the U.S. condemned publicly the attacks and expressed their full support to President Bush on his war against terrorism. Now, 1 year later, Muslims are still apologetic, as if we were responsible for what happened. What are your comments?
Well, I would never apologize. Christians didn't apologize when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. It was an act by a Christian, but Christians weren't expected to apologize. I don't see why if a Muslim Muslims commit an act, all Muslims should apologize. Certainly we offer condolences, but no apologies are necessary.
American Muslims didn't speak out against the war in Afghanistan, I suppose because we didn't want anyone to question our patriotism. We now know that more innocent victims died in Afghanistan than on September 11. Are Muslims remembering those victims today?
Well, I've received a lot of notices from various Muslim organizations of ceremonies they've planned for first 2-3 days of this week, and I don't recall reading in any of them anything about the victims of Afghanistan.
It's not politically correct to use those words, and many Muslims in North America don't dare ask the question, is this a war on Islam? You have published a book called The War on Islam.
Well, there's a lot of damage being done to Muslims in Muslim countries across the world. And each one of them is a combination of several reasons. Now, predominantly, the reason is economic. That's not to say that in the minds of some of the aggressors, Islam is also part of the problem. But if you take, say, Central Asia and Middle East, the reason those in power are interested in that part of the world for the simple reason, their energy resources, oil and gas. Now, if you take, say, what's happening in Palestine, there are so-called Christian Zionists that have a religious reason for them. They have religious reason behind it, not just economic. So the reason differs around the globe. The bottom line in general is that Muslims are by far the largest number of victims. Now, whether you call it a war on Islam or a war for oil and gas, it depends on whose perspective.
There is much talk about a clash of civilizations, especially between Islam and the West, or so they want us to believe. What do you think?
Well, I think that is utter nonsense. For one, you know, even the Western civilization, if you listen to some of those who know more about the foundations of Western civilization, such as His Royal Highness Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, when he gave a major speech in England about 5-6 years ago, he said what the West doesn't realize is that a big part of our civilization is based on Islamic civilization. And there have been more wars within say, Christianity itself. The terrible wars that happened in Europe, I don't recall the equivalent of that in the Muslim countries. The Jews were, the damage done to the Jews was by Christians. So I don't buy this theory of the clash of civilizations. That theory is promoted by those who wish to have a clash so they can go for the energy resources.
You have a publication entitled The Truth About Islam. What are the most common misconceptions about Islam that emerged and flourished during this past year?
Well, that's a message, 600-word message, was written about 7 years ago. And it was intended to address the major misconceptions in America about Muslims. I guess the first one would be, if you tell most Americans what's the first word that you associate Islam or Muslim with, they would say either terrorism or fundamentalist or something close to that, which is the exact opposite of Islam. Islam basically is a religion of peace. And the so-called fundamentalist is a term that is more appropriate to the Christian religion, where it is, has a defined meaning, defined by Christians. There isn't the same sort of thing in Islam. The word fundamentalist, as we're referring to Muslims, is used in a different sense by different persons, so it's not always clear what they're referring to. That was one. The other is tolerance. I doubt if there's any other religion that explicitly has such words of tolerance for other religions as does Islam. So these are misconceptions. Also about Islamic law, the Sharia, there are, yes, it can be misused and misapplied, but if you apply it wisely as you're supposed to, it's not very different from Western law. There are religious beliefs that are prescribed by the Quran, but the civil matters, according to Muslim jurists, are subject to a lot of interpretation, and that's why we have several schools of law in Islam. These are probably the salient points that come out. Also, the equality of men and women, which was in Islam long before it was even considered in the West.
There are an estimated 7 million Muslims in the U.S. Roughly half of them are Afro-Americans. The rest originally came from various Islamic countries. Many still carry with them inherited differences. What effect, if any, did the events of September 11 have on the Muslim communities in the U.S.?
You know, that's a hard one. I think one thing that was common to all Muslim communities was the sense of fear and insecurity. I understand there are many Muslim students that actually left the United States for that very reason. So that is perhaps the common theme running through the different Muslim communities, the sense of insecurity, and which was had some real basis because so many Muslims were locked up without charge by the government. And there was also an increase of incidents against Muslims. I guess that would be the major themes that run through the major through the many Muslim communities.
During Labor Day weekend, an estimated 32,000 Muslims attended the Islamic Society of North America convention in Washington, D.C. Now, this is a very large gathering. Would you like to give us some thoughts about what went on in this convention, and did you think it was different from the previous years?
Well, I hate to say this, but this is the first ISNA meeting I've attended. It gives one a warm feeling to see that there are so many Muslims doing so many different things around the country, and you have this sense of community. You also listen to so many Muslim scholars, and this is all the positive side. On the negative side, this was a tremendous opportunity because it was being covered by C-SPAN to give Americans our perspective on the two things we need to tell Americans most, One is Islam in very few words, and that we did to some extent. But the more important thing is why things are happening for which Muslims are apparently being blamed. And Americans don't have, for most Americans, don't have a clue as to what our government is doing in our name overseas that causes such reaction among Muslims. Here we have a nation that has perhaps the highest level of communications technology, and yet it is so poorly utilized. We are separated by these large oceans from the rest of the world. We have a media that's, I guess, censors itself, free by law, but it censors itself, and with the result that Americans get so little news of the rest of the world. You know, I travel overseas to many countries in the course of my work, and I can listen to BBC International, I can listen to the French press, the German press, even CNN International, and that is hard. You cannot get those in the U.S. So Americans are basically cut off from the rest of the world, and that is something. It's up to Muslims to try to overcome that. And I didn't see enough of that being done at ISNA. Of course, to be fair to them, that may or may not be their charter.
Well, indeed, I was going to mention that in Iraq, every month more than 5,000 children die. And this has been going on for the last 12 years. And yet, American Muslim voices are noticeably absent among those who oppose a strike on Iraq.
That's right. You know, I was in South Africa recently, and that community seemed to be much more vocal in voicing these concerns. They had radio stations, they had satellite radio that reached 55 countries, they have all kinds of radio broadcasts where you can get this information, but we don't do that. In fact, just a few days ago, I received an email about a Muslim organization, a national Muslim organization, that is going to send around a bunch of books to American libraries, thousands of them. And in that list, I didn't see one book that would express the Muslim perspective, or for that matter, the perspective of newspapers such as the British Independent and the Guardian, to Americans on political events. They've got the funds, but for whatever reason, they hesitate to use them to voice concerns such as these.
What future do you see for Muslims in the U.S.?
Well, how could you repeat that, please?
What future do you see for Muslims in the U.S.? Are you optimistic?
I'm reminded of Shakespeare from my high school days. Things at their worst must cease or else go up. So I guess when things get bad enough, things will get better. That's about all I can say. One thing, though, Muslims are much more awake today. And also Americans are much more interested in what Muslims have to say. So, you know, it's up to us whether it's the future, to some extent, is in our hands. It depends what we do with it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Massoud.
Thank you.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial in Montreal or www.ckut.ca on the internet. This is a caravan and our very special edition for September 11. Our commentary today is from the Pakistani newspaper Dawn, dated September 6, 2002 and written by Maher Ali. September 11 is often cited as the day the outside world decided to pay America a visit. The murderous manner of the intrusion was certainly uncalled for and remains worthy of unequivocal condemnation. But let's not lose sight of the fact that the U.S. has been visiting the world for more than a century, often with deadly, albeit usually less spectacular, results. Shock, horror, fear, mourning. These were perfectly natural responses to the enormity of passenger-laden jets plowing into the most potent symbols of American economic and military power. The frenzied flag-waving that followed was also understandable. But ought not these gut reactions have given way in due course to greater introspection? It is at least conceivable that a better America, less insular, less arrogant, less ignorant, could have arisen from the ashes of the Twin Towers. What we get instead is a debate about whether the structure proposed to replace the hole in Manhattan's heart will have an equivalent amount of commercial space. In other words, will it be equally lucrative? Even more alarmingly, what we get instead is a degree of unilateralism rarely encountered since Second World War. The concept of preemptive military strikes against suspected enemies would have been marginally less offensive had its primary implication been, let's kill them before they kill us. But it's not. It's more like, let's neutralize anyone who might hold a grudge that could one day possibly lead to violence against U.S. property or personnel. There goes half of the world, at least. At the domestic level, the aftermath of September 11 has involved a progressive whittling away of civil liberties. Racial profiling has become commonplace. Tolerance of dissent has decreased markedly, and academic freedom has taken at least a few body blows. To cite but one example, the Washington Post reported last month that the University of North Carolina, quote, finds itself besieged in federal court and across the airwaves by Christian evangelists and other conservatives, end of quote, because it requires all first-year students to read a text titled Approaching the Quran, Early Revelations. The book was chosen in an attempt to promote a better understanding of Islam, which clearly makes sense in the circumstances. This is precisely the sort of narrow-mindedness that creates the impression of an America determined to teach the world a lesson, but unwilling to learn any lessons itself. But not all Americans have succumbed to the disease, and therein shines a ray of hope. For if the U.S. is ever to change, the momentum for that transformation will have to be generated from within. Take Walter Mosley, the writer and activist. Quote, Because of our history and our experience right here in America as well as in Africa, we have an understanding of the rage and anger of America's so-called enemies. Black people know that most Arabs and Muslims are good people, that their beliefs are just as valid as Christian beliefs, that they have been at the receiving end of American so-called foreign policy for years. As a people of color, we know how America treats other people of color with suspicion or disdain. What I believe is that the only way to make sure that sort of atrocity does not happen again is to make sure we don't do it to anyone else. When people say, "Surely you don't want this to happen to America again," my answer is, "I don't want it to happen to anyone again." You cannot ignore rage. It just doesn't go away. It only goes away when the causes of that rage are addressed. You do not have to look outside America to see that this is the case. Guantanamo Bay is unlikely to figure in any speeches. The U.S. naval base in Cuba is a prison for hundreds of captives, most of them probably Taliban foot soldiers who have been deprived of their rights under the Geneva Convention. Where would the Bush presidency be today without 9/11? Still struggling to overcome the stigma of its dubious legitimacy and mired in corporate sleaze, the Bush's coterie reputation for scandalous business practices may be of greater immediate concern to Iraqis than to Americans, because the next batch of damaging revelations may be preempted by an assault against Baghdad. In this context, the concept of preemptive strikes almost begins to make sense, notwithstanding its morality. This commentary was by Meher Ali, as published in Dawn, the Pakistani newspaper, dated September 6, 2002. Thank you. listening to Caravan on this very special edition for September 11 that started at 1 p.m. and will go till 3 p.m. today, inshallah. From Washington, we go to Israel, Palestine, 1 year after September 11. Sam Bahur, an American-Palestinian businessman, father of two young daughters, talks to Caravan about terrorism and suicide bombing, the struggle of the Palestinian people, and what American people should realize. On September 16, 2001, Sam Bahur wrote, "This is indeed a historic opportunity to move back from the abyss, to sit down and clean the slate, to move forward. Having looked into the face of hell on earth, reasonable people can only seek to end further suffering. Ending that suffering in our part of the world means ending the occupation, completely and totally, dismantling the settlements, and moving forward towards final status negotiations. Only in this way can we really fight terrorism, by removing the root causes of political violence. Only in this way can we end this conflict. Any other option will bring a plague, at the very minimum, on both our houses, Palestinian and Israeli alike." Sam Bahur has been living in El Bira, the West Bank, for the last 7 years. He is author of Homeland, Stories from Palestine. Mr. Bahur, thank you so much for being with us. What are your thoughts on this day, 1 year after the tragic events of September 11?
Well, as a Palestinian American, I think I have mixed feelings. On one hand, we still are shocked at the bombings of the towers, and we really cannot yet, or at least I cannot yet, absorb fully the damage that was done, not only to the physical damage that was done in New York and to the people who passed away, but the damage that was done to the American society. At the same time, though, living in Palestine, there's a bitterness that the events of September 11th have been abused by the Israeli government to perpetrate what's happening here as being part of this war on terrorism. It's nothing of the sort. There's two different issues completely, and it's a bitter feeling to see that we're paying the price for someone who bombed two towers in the States.
During the last year, you were living in El Bira in the West Bank, and you traveled briefly to the United States. Did you find that Americans knew what Palestinians are suffering?
Unfortunately not. I followed the media there very closely when I took a 10-day trip for a health-related issue. And what I noticed was that the media has turned to completely portray the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in an Israeli mindset. And there was very, very few reports that were bringing both sides of the story. And me, having lived here for the last 7 years, I can tell in every single report that there was an Israeli bias in the reporting, and it was not neutral by any means. As well as just speaking to the general public, I think that I was there in June, so it was almost 9 months after the bombings, that the American public is still confused about who are the enemy and who are their friends. I think they have been blinded by a U.S. administration that basically has made an oversimplified categorization that there's us and them. And I think that the world is much more complicated than just an us and them kind of conflict.
You were very vocal in your condemnation of suicide bombings, whether they occurred in the States, in the West Bank, or Israel. For the last few weeks, there has been no Palestinian suicide operations. Yet Israel hasn't stopped house demolitions, bombing, and continuing its imposition of a strict curfew. I'd like your comments on this.
I remain very vocal, and I think even more people within the Palestinian society have become more vocal in standing against suicide bombings. We do not feel that it promotes the just Palestinian cause. like today I was speaking to a friend, if we view the killing of 10 Israelis or 100 Israelis or a million Israelis, we have to still ask the same exact question, what next? And what next is that we're going to find a way to coexist together, and it would make much more sense if we would stop the bloodletting and reach some kind of political solution today. And I say this to my Israeli friends mostly, because they have the power to end the occupation tomorrow morning, and this would put the political track back on a positive direction. There is no other way. There is no occupation that lives forever. However, having said that, I'm seeing a transformation of my own society. It's becoming much more bitter. And as I told an Israeli friend today, I told him, you know, in grade school they teach us in science class a theory that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. So if anyone thinks that the entire Palestinian society during the last 5 months and even more than that is being shattered day by day by tanks and armored personnel carriers and F-16s and Apache helicopters, if these armaments are going to destroy our society as they have, we would be naive to think that there's not going to be a reaction from the Palestinian side, just out of a natural reaction. It's upon our leaders to become, on both sides, aware of that and reach a agreement that we need to start the political process and not disrupt it every time that there is a reaction on the ground. For 5 months, we've been battered by the fourth most powerful army in the world. Israel would be naive to think that once that the rope is released from the Palestinians' neck, that some Palestinian is not going to respond violently to what has happened to us. We need to look beyond the next act of violence and look about how to end the occupation, because that's the core problem. And with the ending of the occupation, we can open the doors up to solve the more difficult problems, such as the refugee issue, the Jerusalem issue, and others.
Is the case of Palestine a lesson for America that no matter what might an army might have and use, there cannot be peace without justice?
Definitely. And the U.S., I think, outside of the media blitz that's happening now with regards to Iraq and Afghanistan, if they would look at the Palestinian issue, inside the makings of the Palestinian issue, our struggle is a very American struggle. We're fighting for civil rights, we're fighting for national rights, we're fighting against discrimination. These are American values that every single American, when explained in a very calm and neutral fashion, will not say that it's wrong to defend these kinds of values. We are doing what any American would do. We are resisting a foreign occupation, just as Americans resisted a British occupation. And I think that it's about time that the American administration starts to reflect the true interests of America in the region. And those true interests are not to support an occupying army, not to support a discriminative government, but rather to find stability in the Middle East. And stability in the Middle East comes by bringing justice to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, ending the occupation, and allowing two independent sovereign states to grow as they wish without the interference of each other. And if America would reflect this, they would be reflecting their core values. What we see today is America reflecting maybe some corporate values from some very big corporate values or some military industrial values, but they're definitely not representing the values of the American people.
Mr. Bush is making a case for his attack against Iraq because he says Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and that he is a threat to his neighbors. We know that this was true 12 years ago, before the Gulf War. For the last year, Israel has not only threatened but reoccupied Palestinian territories. Yet we haven't heard enough Palestinian officials drawing attention to this parallel between Mr. Sharon and Mr. Saddam Hussein.
The parallel is definitely there, and we need as Palestinians to do a better job in portraying our cause to the public through media and other devices. At the end of the day, America moved and acted when Kuwait was occupied by Iraq. America moved and acted in Eastern Europe. America moved and acted almost in every continent of this world. But when it comes to the Israeli occupation that has sustained now for 36 years, not 1 year, not 5 months, but 36 years, America still blindly supports not bringing this issue to the United Nations forum. They continue to veto even United Nations resolutions that call for Israel to end the occupation and to end the violence against the Palestinian community. Time has come, it's past time, that America also acts against its ally in the region for the sake of its ally as well, in bringing them in line with international law in order for them to be a strong ally. If America continues to support Israel while it occupies our lands, if America continues to give weapons to Israel in order to destroy our societies, then the issue will have to revert back to the Americans themselves. Part of the solution, a major part of the solution to this issue, is the American administration and how the interests are being defined. If interests in America are going to continue to be defined through pro-Israeli lobbies, then I think America has a problem, and it's not the Palestinians, it's within American society. And it's time for the American citizen to stand up for democracy and to stand up for their own values by telling their elected officials that what America needs in the Middle East is stability and an end to occupation. And no lobby, no matter how strong and how powerful, should blind American legislators to promote peace in the Middle East through ending the occupation.
Mr. Bahawi, thank you very much. CKUT 90.3 FM.